This episode is sponsored by Hacksoft, your Django development partner beyond code. More on their services later in the show.
Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to have Chris Maid join us today. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hello, Will. Hello, Carlton. Great to
hello,
see you
Chris.
Guys.
Thank you for coming on.
So we've known you for quite a while now through conferences and stuff, and so much delayed having you on, but maybe you could tell us what are you up to these days, and then we'll dive into your previous talks and backstory. But how are you using Django today?
Mostly for my website, honestly. I've built that. I'm trying to remember how long ago. It's been definitely over a decade since I've put it on top of Django, and now I use Wagtail to power it. And sadly, that's the primary way I'm using Django right now, except for all my little experiments at work. Were mostly FastAPI or Starlet. I keep saying, but Django's a really good option. So I guess you could say I'm a polyglot for Python web frameworks.
On your personal site, so you can make that however you want, right? Like, are you on 5.2 or planning to? I mean, that just came out a couple days ago as we record. So
right. This is the shame part. I do not know exactly what version I have. I had it open yesterday, but the numbers don't stick in my head. But it's definitely not, I don't even think I'm on the latest LTS, honestly. Mainly because my local setup, ever since I got my new computer, I just haven't spent the time to get it set up correctly. You know, I'm kind of in some ways in maintenance mode on my personal website. Just trying to clear up some time to upgrade everything.
Yeah. Well, that's how you know you're a professional, right? Like you don't have time to fully perfect everything. So
yeah, the web developer's website is never up to date.
No, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, as long as it's running, right?
Carlton, you must have a take on
that. No, well, I'm just sitting here smiling as Chris tells his, my Django's not quite up to date. No, it's still going. It hasn't fallen over. Why would it fall over? That's the great thing, right? You can, you can update it when you're ready.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if it's well architected, then you don't have to think about it. I know we talk about the latest versions and features, but the reality is it's a huge map of what you actually have to do. And yeah, not having to keep up with Django is a big reason why we use Django, because it's there if you want it, but it's probably not going to break on you.
Can I swing back quickly, Chris? You talked about your work. You're doing using Starlet FastAPI there. What's the applications, if you can talk about that a little?
So I work for a company that makes software for the health industry. And so I've been on a couple of projects. Like the current one I'm on is kind of a essentially like an internal tool that it's funny. Like I've joined this company for less than a year, so I don't understand all the organizational aspects of it, or even all the offerings they have. There's one tool where it's related to people who have post-acute care. So essentially a patient comes into the system, they have a giant document of their medical history, or at least recent medical history. And as a part of the flow, a nurse has to go review each one, a nurse has to review some of them. They have a team of nurses. And so my services, the point of it is to get that packet of information and leverage AI to ask it a bunch of questions and summarize it for the nurses. So that they don't have to. They can, it's funny because one of the best things about it is we're trying to figure out how reliable is this, thankfully it's been incredibly reliable. So that's, we keep doing blind tests and stuff like that. And so, thankfully for at least this application, the AI is
okay. So my sort of take on this is that if you're getting them to reduce, if you put in more context than you're asking them to output, they are very reliable because they're summarizing an amount rather than, whereas if you only give them a little bit and try to get them to output a lot, that's when you're in big trouble.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm here in Boston, and so there's several startups just in my co-working space doing similar things. You know, so one is using AI to tap into Athena Health to do for doctors or nurses, I guess, but when you do get your blood work and stuff or things like that, right, it pass it through AI first because it will flag if something's off, and And I guess I think I've talked to them quite a bit over the over the months, and a lot of things in medicine are somewhat routine, or and you have these you know, nurses and doctors who are just completely overworked, and so something that saves them time that they still need to, they can still review and sign off. There's still a human there for a variety of reasons, but AI is great, right? It's not like nobody's building an agent yet for healthcare, right? Whereas coding, like somehow we're all replaceable, but you know, maybe it's maybe it has to do with the billing and the insurance.
I've just realized where I've been going wrong as well, because we've just said that you know, if you give them a big context and ask for a small one out, you can do quite well. Whereas the other way around, whereas I'm like, can you write my UI for me, and they give me the UI. It's like, hang on, the UI was more than I gave it, so perhaps I need to up my prompting.
But I mean, but coding is such a broad, it's sort of kind of infinite, right? If you said, hey, build a Django front end, what are you doing? Are you using HTMX? Are you using React? Are you, you know, blah, 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 right? Whereas in the context, I would imagine in a medical one, it's much more specific. But actually, I have a question on that. So are you using, or are they using, not off the shelf, but, you know, like ChatGPT kind of stuff? Or are they using, because there's now a lot of these more targeted domain-specific LLMs?
We're using, we're on the GCP platform, and I think we're using Vertex AI to do the RAG questions and stuff like that, the processing.
Okay. Do you get to play around with that whole part at all, or you're more on the website?
I'm up more on the website. I have a very small team. There's three of us, and one, the kind of the senior, the architect of our area, he's like, this is my baby. I want to play with this.
Yeah.
So I get to look at his code, but I'm handling all the web stuff, which is my baby. So that's wonderful.
Right. Well, just going off of my discussions with people I know here doing something a little bit similar, some of the things they've mentioned that didn't occur to me at first is that, you know, because the prompts are, you know, in English and you get it to work, but it's specific to that model. So, you know, like a new model, right? There's constantly updated models. The process of, you know, it's not as smooth an update from like Django 4.2 to 5.2 as it is going on whatever version with the LLMs, because you're sort of back to square one. So I guess I imagine that's also the case for your colleague, that you're really kind of, it's harder to switch because the LLMs and the prompts, it's not code, it's sort of English.
Yeah. And we definitely have a tool that we have a few, you know, trial PDFs that don't have, you know, patient information, or, you know, we have, it's sanitized, let's say. And so we have a tool that I can, you know, we essentially have a Python script that you aim it at a PDF file, tell it which model you want it to do. And it'll do the whole process so that we can test each new model as they come out and see how they perform.
Right.
That's the trick, the engineering trick, it seems, is to have some kind of test harness which can validate know, whether your prompts are still working.
Yeah, and we have a team of a few project managers who are, and other people on the, you know, the team that we're serving who are former nurses and things like that. So there's a lot of industry knowledge. So we pretty much run this and go, here, is this good? You tell us.
Gonna just say you've been at the engineering a while, right? So this, you've got, because, you know, we're going to go on and talk about your talks, which is just super, but you come at it with a lot of background.
I've been building websites since 1995, so that's, you know, a couple of years, but I graduated with a degree in graphic design, mainly because I thought I wanted to be a computer scientist but couldn't understand what they were trying to teach me, so switched to graphic design. Absolutely love that. I used to say that I'm really the product of my parents. My dad is an engineer. He thinks about how things work and things like that. My mom is an artist. And so I'm very much using both sides of my brain. And so I love the graphic display of, you know, websites and trying to figure out how to make a really great user experience, and then having the engineer prowess to, you know, actually make it possible and to make it as smooth as possible and, you know, have a well-readable, well-understandable code at if I can. So essentially back in roughly around 2007 is when I started using Python, and just a few years later I started using Django, and Yeah, that's kind of been my passion is you know, making the user experience as best as it can be, both for the users and for the developers. So somewhere in there too, I learned to program as an adult, I had a lot of feeling like I didn't belong, and I did a lot of learning from the people around me. And as I tried to, like, whenever I'd learn, either through a blog post or a podcast or, you know, somebody on my team, I would try to make a habit of, like, sharing it with another colleague of mine, because I figured, like, if I just learned this, then they might want to learn too. And about a third of the time, they're like, yeah, I already knew that. Yeah, thanks, sure. About a third of the time, they were like, wow, well, I didn't know that. Thank you. But the best part was, like, a third of the time, people would be like, well, that's true under these circumstances, but here's a thing that you might want to know. And so kind of by doing this, I also felt like I've kind of, as I grew as a developer, I also grew as a coach, because I got to, you know, share with people. And then eventually, like, when I became a lead developer, which was a major anxiety point in my life as an imposter, I didn't know what to do for a couple of weeks until I finally thought, what would my podcast say to do? And I just tried to invest in those around me. And that's kind of what I've been doing for the last few years. And I've been really enjoying that too.
I like that little story, because as you began it, I was thinking, well, you know, the teaching is learning kind of thing. So, you know, if you come across something new, if you try and teach it to a third person, then, you know, you ground that knowledge a bit deeper in yourself. But then when you get that feedback of that third of the time and someone says, but have you considered this? It's like, that's the circle's
going to be. The strong opinions loosely held kind of thing is what I try to strive for.
Well, I think if you learned how to program within these organizations because you're coming from the graphic design side, you had those colleagues. I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, don't have that at all. I didn't have that when I was learning how to code, and it really hinders you. You have to find, if not a community, a group, right, where you can bounce ideas and have some give and take. It's a little bit easier now with Discord and the forums and stuff, but, you know, back when I learned how to code, it was Stack Overflow, and you didn't want to go in there with a question that wasn't perfect. You would get lit up.
Totally. Yeah, and actually, to that point, in the first programming job I had, I was learning Python. I was loving it, and one of my colleagues was also very passionate about Python, and so the two of us were like, wait a minute, Richmond, Virginia needs a place for Python developers to hang out. So we created PyRVA. And we've actually, we're closing in on 10 years of PyRVA. And, we're trying to create a little community where people can just kind of come together and, you know, learn together. And absolutely.
Well, there's I'm not going to say surprising, but there is quite a scene in Richmond. I mean, several people we've had on this podcast. I mean, Justin Duke from Button Down, I believe Andrew Mishar. Richmond has always had, what was it? There was a very prominent digital agency that's been there for a long time, right?
Yes, probably. And I probably don't realize how prominent it is because it's Richmond.
I remember, 20 years ago, because I went to college in Williamsburg, Virginia. So
that's right.
I had some sense of the Virginia thing. And
that's where I grew up, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Anyways, well, so you started in the graphic design. So then did you go into, what did that mean? Was that like graphic, or were you have a chance to do a bunch of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript before you went over to Python?
A little bit of both. So when I started web development, there was no CSS. But all my computer science friends said, damn it, Chris, your websites are so much better looking than ours. And so I kind of had, I won a copy of Photoshop in some high school, competition. So I was always messing with graphics and stuff like that. But then I, through the graphic design thing, I essentially got pulled away from web development. And so I was doing, all the print stuff. In fact, at first I had a hard time finding a job because they were like, you have too much web experience. We want more print experience. And so then I ended up getting a job at an advertising agency and did a lot of, logo work, brochures, that kind of thing. But also, they realized, he knows how to do websites. And so I would do at that time I learned CSS. So I did HTML and CSS, but not JavaScript, because I thought JavaScript was Java, and I hated Java applets, and I was like, there's no way I'm learning any of that. And then in my next job was similar. I was at a trucking company that's nationwide. It's called Estes Express Lines. And essentially, that was awesome at first. Like, you would think doing design for a trucking company would not have much variety, but I got to do everything from, of course, the decals in the truck and brochures to custom board games and product photography. It was shocking. And then at some point, they needed somebody to help implement the website, because they bought the design of the website, but not the implementing of it. And I was like, I'd be happy to help out. And that's when I learned that JavaScript is not Java, and started reading blog posts and listening to podcasts. And then I realized at some point I was learning all the things that the computer science teachers were trying to teach me, but I was doing it through blog posts and the way people were, you know, talking about it there. It's like, oh, now I get it, you know? And yeah.
Well, especially front end, it's hard for the teachers to keep up. Right. I mean, it's one thing if you're teaching the core algorithms course in Java, but if it's JavaScript and all these things, right? I mean, they're especially if you're in a truly academic setting, you have so many other things you have to deal with. You can't keep up, really. I mean, right? Because they're not practitioners generally.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how many people are learning HTMX in college right now.
Well, yeah. I mean, if they are, it's, you know, some adjunct teaching it.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, same with web development, right? I mean, because my books are taught at some universities, but it's always web is not a core part of the computer science curriculum.
That's a good point. Yeah, absolutely.
I wish it were.
Because that's one thing I've been thinking about too. Is like, you know, every now and then I get into a conversation of like how worth it is college, and it's like, I think, you know, in certain ways it definitely is worth it, but it's like, you know, the computer science is not, like you said, web development. It is a lot of theory, and of course, you know, great for, you know, I know some people who are learned a lot in computer science, you know, courses, and, you know, they're great at all the algorithms, and they are really smart in that way. But, you know, I guess really what it comes down to is this world is just so complicated that just a, you know, the colleges are trying to do their best, I would think, but like computer science is not, you know, I think the college I went to also had like a information technology degree, which was, at the time I was like, how is that different from computer science? Of course, it's very different, and I still don't know exactly how, but it's like, it's hard to like, you can't have, you know, a degree in every single discipline, I guess.
Well, if you did IT, you can fix the problem.
Well, I mean, the three of us, none of us have formal computer science experience, right? I mean, and here we are. I mean, I think one of the things about web that is so helpful that I wish there was a little bit more is that it's one of the few things you can jump right in and immediately get your hands dirty. Yeah. And, you know, Carlton's used this analogy of like the grandfather clock with deployments, but I think having a project where, you know, you can build a site, have it interact with people, you know, add analytics, you don't get that with writing, you know, Python scripts for like a TikTok, tic-tac-toe, you know, like it's not visceral and doesn't kind of keep you going in the same way.
Totally.
Whereas web is, right, you can kind of get going, and it's just nice to have something to put a toehold in. And I think that's the challenging thing about computer science is you do have some students who've web or AI or whatever, they already have the context. They sort of see how it can be applied. And then you have just bright students showing up being like, what is this thing? And you're dealing with people who've been, you know, A, have the context, and B, have been doing it for years. And you just don't have that, you know, like chemistry. People don't walk in with like 6 years of chemistry experience to the intro to chemistry, right? So I do feel a lot of people are like, oh, computer science isn't for me. It's like, well, no, like you're comparing yourself in the wrong, you're comparing yourself in the wrong place, and you completely lack the context, which if you, certain minds, you know, love the abstract nature of computer science, but I think most people want to do something with their skills, and I think it's like only the upper levels you kind of, well, it depends what you want to do, right? I personally, like the nuance of database abstractions is not my cup of tea, but some people it is. I'm just like, get the data, throw it over here, like, let's go.
And to your point, you know, too, I was thinking about how just a couple of years ago, you know, we had a session at PyRVA, and you know, I need to remember to do this, but every now and then I remember, like, you know, we have the session at the theme is this, but I also want to add, you know, if there's anybody here who has a question about Python, I'd be happy to, you know, help or whatever. And so one of these days I remember to do it. And this gentleman came up, you know, young man who was working on a really old computer. And he was like, I want to know how to, I want to make a website, you know, with Python. How can I do it? And, you know, over the course of, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes, I helped him to download Django, or create a virtual environment, download Django. And we ended up with the, you know, the starter page when you get everything up and running initially. And like, he lit up.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden he saw that he could do these things, and it does it. He can load the web page in his browser and it's running on his computer. And it was such a magical moment. And then I was excited because just, was it this month or last month, he came back to PyRVA and was like, Chris, thank you for all your work you did. I now have a job in web development thanks to you. And I was just like, well, thanks to you, because you did all the hard work. I just showed you how to get started. And, you know, I think that is such a great thing to be able to experience, you know, like you said, like doing something and having it, you know, the change and experience it is
yeah,
wonderful.
I think of it as the aha moments.
Like, yeah.
you get a lot in web development and you need them periodically, or most people need them. Maybe Carlton's a philosophy PhD, so maybe he can just read the manual and be good to go.
I don't know if that's true. Like, I can read the manual, then I can sit there staring at a syntax error for 5 hours, you know, when I finally realize it was a missing semicolon.
That's because you're not using LLMs enough, Carlton. That is a good use case for...
Or too much.
Well, yeah.
Or too much.
Yeah, no, well, we don't need to get totally just... Yeah.
LLM stories.
Well, I just wanted to get to HTMX and stuff, but I don't know where you were headed.
Well, yeah. So I was going to ask, Chris, you said you're interested in user experience and crafting the thing. And we know you've done these talks on HTMX and SBAs and things, but I wanted to kind of back up a second. So is that, have you done the React stuff? You've done the other things? And like, where do you think the richness of UI is best, or depends on what you're doing, or, you know, I'll give you it depends out straight away.
Essentially, yeah, I went deep into the single page application environment. As somebody who cared so much about user experience, I was working at a creative agency at that time, and, you know, heard about this React thing that came about. I was doing research on it, and I was like, I need to find a really good use case for this. And eventually found one. Actually, we ended up using Vue at that time instead of React, but of course I've kind of dipped my toe into all of them and loved it for years, you know. And then at one point in one of the podcasts I was listening to, the person was saying, you know, I realized that I think it was the same person I mentioned in my talk, where he realized that all the work he was doing in I think he was also using Vue at the time, it's just like so much more work than he did when he was just using Laravel. And that kind of planted a seed in my head. And I started looking at my projects and thinking, yeah, you know, we're validating things twice, you know, as smooth and as wonderful as the user experience is, we're having to do a lot of work to get that to happen. And essentially I, you know, kept experimenting with things along the way. But it wasn't until David Guillot's talk at DjangoCon Europe in 2023 where I was like, oh, HTMX is much more than I thought it was, you know? And starting at that point, I was like, what that team did was amazing. And I need to like do some research into this. And so, you know, experimented it with myself. And, you know, for me, it's like, I think the biggest, where they're essentially, you know, like I kind of talk about how like it's for the user experience and the developer experience is really what it comes down to for me a lot. And that initial page load it hampers the vast majority of single page applications. And so like, that's why, you know, my talk, I talk about streaming the HTML so that like pretty much you tell the browser to go to the page, you start getting content back and you can interact with that content. I love that. And then having, you know, a progressive enhancement, enhanced experience so that like, you know, especially, oh my God, I don't know how many times I go to a website and I try to click something or try to interact with it. And it's like, nope, not yet, because you haven't finished loading. It's maddening.
The example which comes to mind is GitHub. So, I mean, I'm sure it's fine if you're in San Francisco, but I live in Spain. And so, like, literally, I'll be trying to review a pull request and it'll be click, and multiple seconds will pass before that click does anything. It's like, no, this isn't, this isn't progress.
Yeah, yeah. And our bank just updated their web presence or their, you know, what the stuff that you sign on to. And it's just like, okay, so I've now loaded this page. I have to wait 7 more seconds for a summary of my accounts. And then I have to click into that. And I have to, for some reason, as soon as it's live, you click on the link, it doesn't do anything. We have to wait another second or two before it goes. And it's just like, this is not what we...
Yeah, and you know which link you want to click, right? So if that link just functioned, you could be on.
I don't even know if I could deep link to it now that I think about it. That might save some time.
Hacksoft is your development partner beyond code. From custom software development to consulting, team augmentation, or opening an office in Bulgaria, they're ready to take your project to the next level.
Can I ask you a question about the HTMX methodology? Because I picked it up, I don't know, a few years ago now. The thing that really struck me was the way it kind of ties into HTTP, how it ties in, you know, that you use the HTTP verbs, you use the gets and the posts and the puts and the deletes. And it just felt like it was kind of the web in a way that, for me, that was why it worked so well with Django, because like the patterns that Django wanted, HTMX just enabled. And it was like, okay, I think that, I don't know. We get a lot of return on investment from leaning into the web in that way.
And it's funny too, because like when I kind of dove into the HTMX, I also did Alpine.js at the same time. And I really loved, you know, that locality of behavior, you know, so you can just work on one little component and have everything defined. Oh, and Tailwind, I had Tailwind too, like that, another story. And so everything right there in your HTML. And I loved that. But I also acknowledged that like that is a lot of... Like that adds a lot of weight to the HTML, which I don't think, as far as, you know, the kilobytes across the wire, I don't think it matters that much. But what, you know, some of the things I concerned about is when, you know, the person comes up behind me or me in 6 months, will I be able to understand that? And usually I can, because, you know, like I have like I think it's called Rusty Wind. It kind of sorts Tailwind classes so that like I kind of know, like, okay, you know, it might take a little bit, but it's like, oh yeah, each of these things mean specific things. That's excellent. But like sometimes the Alpine.js stuff, I'm like, what was I thinking? You know, that one's a little harder.
The trouble is, it's like in the old days of jQuery, when you could just, you know, you select your element and then you just do a line of, and then your line would get longer and it would get longer and it would get longer, and in the end you'd be like, I've done too many lines here. The same danger applies with Alpine, right? Because one line of JS, no problem. At any given moment, one little bit more, no problem. But all of a sudden, it's like, hang on, I've written an entire JavaScript in an attribute on one element. That's
totally. Yeah, one of the experiments I did, well, I guess I can't really say it's an experiment because I was doing it for a client. We were doing a rules engine, and so I was hired by the vice president of the company, and so he was like, okay, I'm going to work on it in React, and you work on it in Alpine, and we'll see like how it comes about. And pretty quickly, he was like, wow, this Alpine version is much simpler. So he kind of joined me on that for a little while. But then it was just like, it's just kind of crazy because like in some ways it was super cool because we just had native HTML form elements, you know, field sets with inputs and labels and all these things styled to look amazing, and had all these hidden text fields to kind of carry some of the data around with it. And so, yeah, in some ways it was like a technical, I felt like this is amazing because like, you know, everything was just in the form. The state was in the HTML, and then, you know, you submit it and it's just the form requests going out. But oh my God, like all the template inheritance and all the like special cases, I was like, yeah, there's definitely some kind of balance in between the two that would be good. So especially right now, I'm looking into like web components and trying to figure out how to kind of, what's the next stage, you know, like, Alpine.js is awesome for like, you know, the small things that you can handle. Obviously it can handle so much more. You can, you know, you don't have to tie things straight to the HTML element. You can, you know, add things through Alpine Magics and stuff. But, you know, I know David Guillou uses Stimulus in his projects. And so, and there's, I mean, so many other things in Django Cotton, I think. And I just, you know, that's one of the things I'm frustrated with at work. It's like, I want to try some of these things, but we are not using Django. So
what's the UI stack at work? Is it the React type thing? Or?
No. Well, so I'm sorry. I should say yes. For like the projects I've been on, not my current project. The current project I'm doing with HTML and Tailwind and actually Pico and Alpine. But yeah, the other projects, they have dedicated teams to do front end development. And so they do.
Okay.
I think it's either React or actually they're polyglot, but you know they have different libraries that they're using and leveraging in the different SPA architectures. But you know,
you're that naughty back end developer who quickly sneaks in a little bit of HTMX on the side when no one's looking. Oh yeah, I just built that because I didn't want to disturb you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the company that I work for has a internal conference, developers conference, once a year. And so last year I essentially gave my DjangoCon talk to them and was like, hey, you know, there's a better way than the single page application route, and it turned a lot of heads, but I don't know that much has come of it.
Well, companies are hard to turn around, right?
Totally. Yeah.
I want to come back to, so you mentioned it's Fast API and Starlet, sort of the underpinnings. Like, why do we talk a lot on this podcast about, you know, fast and whether Django or not is fast? I guess I'm not trying to have you like throw a colleague under the bus, but I'm curious, like, if there are indeed specific asynchronous things with the workflow that you're doing that benefit from that, or more it was someone who thought speed would be important and maybe like how does Django lose out in those situations? Because, you know, like we would say, well, you can use Django and it's something that needs to be fast, like you can do asynchronous things, like, or, you know, where is the speed problem? But like when I'm out in the wild, cause I spend a lot of my time dealing with non Django people now. And, you know, so I hear about Java and Kotlin and all this stuff. And then I also hear about, oh yeah, I gotta be async, gotta be, you know, Fast API and Starlet. And I try to push them on like, what are you talking about? And I haven't really gotten a great answer. I know there are use cases for it, but it generally seems to be more of a sense of, okay, Python web, these are faster, Django's slow. And then, you know, it's a year later and like, you know, you're using these tools and they're good tools, but all right. So that's a long-winded thing. I just like, as a Django diehard, it hurts me a little bit when people say it's slow. And it's like, is it slow? Like,
yeah. And honestly, like I don't feel like it's slow. You know, I know I've seen benchmarks, but it's like, you know, that you can't, I feel like the difference between, you know, say Fast API and Django, it's not worth the, you know, it's negligible in real world.
Right. Unless if you have experience in one or the other, like, you know, go with it for sure.
Yeah.
But I've also yet to see, I mean, you know, maybe if you're doing something truly, truly real time, like, I don't know, chat something or other at scale, chat bot at scale or something. Okay. Maybe. But, maybe I just, well, definitely I need to spend more time with, especially with Fast API. the company I work at supports it and we have integrations, but also I suspect it's a lot, it's not just the speed element, right? People like the newness of it and, you start with something and then you just keep going with it because a lot of these tools are quite good. And
yeah. And in the case of my current project, so I, you know, presented a couple options and the person who, you know, has been shepherding this project was really mostly reacting against what he found in another project in our group. They use Starlet on theirs. And, my colleague was like, I don't like the way that is handling. So let's use Fast API, which of course I'm like, that uses Starlet under the hood. And he's like, yeah, it doesn't matter.
he likes that abstraction better.
Yeah, and I think it's mainly because my colleague is, I don't know how much Python specific experience he has. He's a polyglot. He's a lot of experience in Java, and is, you know, incredibly smart. but he was seeing the code that the team was creating, you know, on top of Starlet. And my impression was that he was not happy with that. Maybe some of the patterns that they use to connect the routes to, you know, the functions that call them. I didn't really dig deep into the why, but I was just like, yeah, pass API. Sounds good. Sure. If that's what you really want, no problem. Let's go with it.
Yeah. I mean, well, Carlton, you're the expert here, but I mean, Starlet is ASGI. It's not really a full-blown, like, I don't know how many people are writing pure Starlet stuff, or maybe they didn't realize they shouldn't be. What do you think, Carlton?
Fast API is a nice layer on top of Starlet, right?
Yeah.
It's a nice...
But why would they use Starlet in the first place, I guess, right? Like, that's sort of... I'm sure they had their reasons.
So I maintain the channels packages, and I see an awful lot of people who are diving into async just because they think they need to. And they're creating... people I often see are creating an awful lot of problems for themselves, which they could just avoid by not doing that way. So I think there is a certain amount of... how do we say? It's async is better no matter what belief out there, which isn't really grounded in reality. I think, and so if that's the case, then well, fast API is the exciting choice there in the space. It's like, okay, that's the one with the mindshare, that's the one we'll go for. I don't think it's in for most of the cases I see, it's not really a technical choice. It's not based on, do you know what, we've got these three throughput requirements for these kind of, you know, none of that's been done. It's literally a vibe choice. And so the interesting question is why Django, because it's old, because why we aren't, our messaging isn't, you know, better. Why aren't, we should be out there banging the drum. Do you know what, Django is still actually the best choice for you out there. If we want to, you know, if we want to stay relevant and stay competing and stay winning the choice in those kind of, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm going to pick a web framework.
I think it's that newness though. Again, like when I see non-Python, non-Django people, they look around, they're like, well, Django's been around for forever. Flask isn't featured enough. Fast is like the new Django. It's got a lot of stars. That sounds good. I think it's pretty much that. And it's, you know, there's nothing against it, right? But it's all, you know, yeah. It's, I don't know if how much of that is that a polyglot thing? Is that just an ignorance thing? You know, because I mean, if I was diving into, I don't know, Rust or something, I might look at something that's newer that has the same amount of stars as something that's older and just like, oh, that seems better without. You know, that's the problem with being a polyglot. Maybe you don't have the depth. I mean, you might, but you probably don't.
Yeah, and I know, you know, and I think it's also trying something new out too. You know, I do feel like sometimes I wonder if I'm really an odd duck because I just will create a project on my computer just to try out a new thing, you know, new tool. And I don't know how many other people really get to do that. And so I think when a new project at work comes around, they're like, oh, then maybe this is my opportunity to try this out, you know?
Well, I think most people don't have full control over what they do. So like you either need to, you know, hopefully find yourself in a consulting or other setting where you can try out new tools, or you just need to do it on your own.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I think like, yeah, it's, you have to have something of your own that like you can play with, like, you know, like a Django thing, right? Like that was like, I have this Learn Django site that I like completely rebuilt last year. And like, there were some business reasons, but a big reason was I just want to have like a real functioning thing that like I can do stuff with. I'm coming up on, there's a whole bunch of stuff I want to do around testing and all these things. And you get kind of tired. I get kind of tired of just like spinning up prototypes. It's nice to have just something I fully control that, you know, matters, but doesn't matter so much. Mm-hmm. Like I made a mistake the other day and I took the site down, you know, for like 5 minutes, but I have tests that said, and I have, you know, I have tracking. And so I quickly fixed it. Right.
Nice.
But
yeah,
that's still 3 9s. It's easy. You know, I mean, 9s do you want? Just hang on before we go. I just want to swing out. I think there's two things we need to do. We need to finish off the async story in Django. It's so nearly there, but like we need to get the ORM async. So we've got the full flow, like we've got the full request response flow. if we had async cursors in the ORM, you know, we could do everything. That would be good. And I think we still need to big up the ecosystem more than we do. The one of Django's absolute strengths is the depth of the ecosystem, and we hardly mention it. And you know, if you're starting out and you're choosing, why is Django a good choice? Well, because you do know that there's this massive depth of ecosystem. Oh no, I didn't really know that. I'm choosing, you know, the core framework against the core fast API framework. Why would I choose Django? Well, it's just older and clunkier. Well, no, but you've got all of these resources just there for you if you want them. And we don't message that very well, I think.
Yeah.
It's a discoverability problem. I mean,
right.
And culturally, like, Django itself is not going to pick favorites there, which, okay, that's fine. But yeah, I don't know. As much as, right, there's Django packages, there's awesome Django, there's people writing great posts, but it's still hidden to people in a way that, well, I mean, you know, like Laravel, right? Like it's a whole separate beast for a lot of reasons, but it just goes, oh, you want this? Boom, use this one, right? It's just all kind of right there and approved. Even though that we could name 10, 20 packages that are kind of official, they're just not actually official.
Yeah, totally.
So, well, the steering council, just on this, the steering council is working on an ecosystem page to go on the site, you know, hopefully in the top banner, saying, so at least there's like a, you know, here's some of the ecosystem, go and explore.
Here's where you might look.
Which we haven't. Yeah, here's where you might look, which we haven't had previously. I think if we can at least guide people out into the wider Django world, we can, you know, do a lot of newcomers to the framework a big favor.
I love that.
Yeah. Sounds good.
So
the other,
go ahead, Carlton. I was going to ask him about his event sourcing article, but you go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that too.
All right, you go.
Well, God, so Chris, the other thing I want to talk to you then is about event sourcing, which is your new hotness. You did a post the other day, and it's going to be a whole series, right?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I'm hoping to launch the second one after we record this. So, like, I wonder how many will be up by the time it goes out. But essentially, you know, I mentioned about how I learned a lot of things through podcasts, and roughly a little over 10 years ago, a number of the podcasts I was listening to, people were like, oh, what's this event sourcing thing? And I started, you know, listening to it, following people, bought a couple courses on it, and was like, wow, this event sourcing thing sounds really interesting. The thing that was really, and actually, now that I think about it, it probably had a lot to do with the whole single page application pattern, because they were, the thing that really made me interested in event sourcing was the idea of always having a fast UI, because essentially, let me rewind and define event sourcing. What event sourcing is it's an application, a architecture for application development, where anytime you want to change the state of the application, you save an event, which essentially represents that delta, into an append-only log of other events. And then the second component of it is, anytime you want to know the current state of an item, you query the relevant events for that item and then replay them in memory. And then, you know, like, that's the current state. And so most event source applications leverage a technique called CQRS, which stands for Command Query Separation, Responsibility Separation, which essentially means the way you save data to the database is different than how you, like, read data to display. And so the idea is, every time an event changes the state, then you have these listeners that listen out for the specific events and can update, you know, database tables or, you know, Redis caches or a file in the file system, anything like that, so that the user experience could be blazing fast. And like I said, that was about 10 years ago that I started listening into that. But, and, you know, a lot of people that I was listening to were really smart, really heady, a lot more than I am. And they were like, you should really, if you want to implement event sourcing, or if you want to use event sourcing, implement it yourself, because it's not that complicated. And plus, you'll know all the little mechanisms. And so I was like, well, I'm never going to do this on a production thing. I'm going to figure it out on my own, right? And so last year I got laid off, and I was in the midst of job searching. I was like, I want to keep sharp. So I was like, well, why not? I've been meaning to do this for 10 years. Let me like actually do it. And so I created my own little event source application and learned it was such a hard thing to do for me. but I learned a ton doing it. And of course, I've known for over 10 years that there's a package on PyPI called event sourcing, which makes it a lot easier. And so all that to say is, I mean, I'm now that I've actually implemented it at work and have a production, or we're not quite in production yet, but the project I'm working on is event sourced. And I'm just seeing, you know, all these other, well, partly also because there are these two gentlemen, Adam Dmitriuk and Martin Dilger, who they've been living the event source lifecycle for over a decade each. And they've figured out ways to simplify working with it, essentially, like how to communicate with the teammates and the business of, you know, what the events are, how things change, how you use the data, organizing your files in such a way so that you don't step any, you can have multiple developers working on the same thing and not step on each other's toes. And then, you know, simplifying, you know, essentially kind of putting guardrails up with event sourcing so you don't get yourself into trouble. And oh my God, it's, it's like one of those things where like, I've been programming for almost 20 years this, but by following the people that I've, you know, around me. And now that I'm doing event sourcing, I'm like, this is so nice. I need to share this with people. You know, you can make your own decisions, but for me, this is very compelling.
So one thing I'm going to ask you about it is the way you kind of get rid of your model objects in a way, because you've got your models are your events. Then you're going to map those to domain objects in your aggregators, in, you know, your functions, which go and get all the events and work out what the current state is. And then those objects come out. So it is really a big kind of shift from the model first approach, right?
It's funny, well, especially if you're using the event, I'm going to say it's not, it is and it isn't, in that because the event sourcing community came out of the domain driven design community. So they are very tied to the aggregate idea. And so therefore the Django model, you know, and so it has a lot of that same thing, especially with the event sourcing package, because you just create a class that works the way you expect it to in Python and you decorate it with some decorators and it automatically creates the events for you transparently in the background. And so if you're just doing it for like, you know, creating models and manipulating or whatever, it's, in a way, it's like not doing anything different. I mean, and there was an extension with the event sourcing package that works with Django. And I haven't experimented with it yet, so I don't know exactly how deep or how similar to Django it is. Like, I thought it said you can use the ORM and stuff, but I'm not sure yet.
Well, you could at least use the ORM for, but I don't know about with the package, but the obvious thing to use the ORM for is your event table, right?
Yeah. You know,
list of events, here they go in that table.
Well, yeah, and it's really interesting because like because it's so like this is one of the things I'm most interested in a way, because with event sourcing being so tied to domain driven design, I feel like in the last few years they're really starting to realize, hey, we don't need to use all this of domain driven design, we don't need to be tied so tightly to it. And so there's like a one of the things I'm learning now is a what they call dynamic context boundaries, which is, of course, a very domain-driven design way of saying flexible, you know, you don't have to be tied to one aggregate. You can say, like, you can create a dynamic boundary to say, like, these are the type of events that I care about. They might span multiple, you know, aggregates, or they might be less than what I would do for one aggregate. You know, like, instead of, like, you know, like, let's say, like, if you have a course, you know, in a college career, a college course, you may not care that the course changed names over the course of its life cycle, but you might want to care about like how many, what's the max number of attendees a course can take. So you can just listen to a subset of events for that one object.
That's a nice example. Well, we're going to link to that. I have played with it the least of the three of us. So I'm looking forward to your new, your second. And how many do you anticipate in the series? Is it a series you're thinking of?
I do. I have 5 drafts right now. I might, like, based on the feedback I get from people, like, because there's tons of questions about it, which I get and I'm encouraged, because Like the more people ask me about it, the better I can explain it, the more better I can, you know, help people. So I'm thinking about maybe adding a sixth one that's kind of like a questions I get asked during this whole thing or something like that to try to, you know, cover up some, or not cover up, but, you know, answer some of those questions.
Right. Yeah. Well, gosh, we're at 50 minutes somehow. So I want to quickly ask you our infamous question about the magic wand in Django. You've listened to our podcast, so
yeah.
you have one. Does something you want to change?
There is something I want to change. And really, in theory, I could change it. I just need to find the time to do it. But it is being able to stream HTML. Like that, I really, seeing how much that can affect user experience. You know, I mentioned sadly in my first talk that, you know, maybe we'll have that in a year. And I was like, why did I even say that? Like I practiced so many times not saying that, but it came out when I said it. But yeah, you know, like I know at one point I think somebody was looking into doing it at a Google Summer of Code, but it hasn't been done. And, you know, and I think partly because you need to make the whole template engine async, which, you know, I don't know how hard or not hard that is, but it's not a priority. So, but that's something I want.
Is this a steering council priority, Carlton?
I think we'd have to see a proof of concept for that. I think, you know, for me, okay, it's so the 5.2 is out the door now. DjangoCon Europe's just around the corner. There will be conversations now will start to happen about, okay, so what are the two or three things you want to push for 6.0, this Django CSP, this the async story. You know, if we could push just the ORM cursors, that would be an amazing thing. I think asyncrifying the template language is, you know, going to have to wait a while for it to become a sort of community project, but if a community priority. But if somebody wants to push it, I think what would I do in this thing? I would split my response into chunks, and I would render each chunk and output it. So, you know, if it say it was a list of items, I'd, you know, stream, render one item, send that, render the next item, send that. And it's close enough. It's not streaming natively from the template, but okay, on the wire, it's going to look very similar.
Yeah, yeah, very true.
But yes, that would be a lovely addition.
Maybe someone listening will
Kind of things need somebody to sit down, roll their sleeves up, and come out sick from their cave 6 months later with it, you know, sort of working.
With a big pizza tab.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Chris, I feel like we're just getting started, but I think we're up on time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But people, we will link to your talk if they didn't see it on HTMX and Django, which was popular at the time, has had a resurgence of late, and everyone, I think it's one of the best. You know, if you have questions about both, go check it out. I was in the room when you gave that talk. So
yeah, yeah, I was so excited I was very looking forward to meeting you afterwards, and I was excited that you wanted to meet me because you enjoyed my talk.
Oh God, please, yeah. No. I mean, that's the great thing about this podcast is I just learn.
I'm very much. I'm very much looking forward to you pushing forward the event sourcing story in Django. I think there's an exciting, you know, extra thing we could have there, extra set of tools.
I think so. Especially, like I said, great user experience, great developer experience, I think. I think it's going to be very interesting. Yeah.
Well, DjangoChat.com, we have links to everything, including all your resources. And thanks for making the time, Chris. Appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. Thank you.
All right, we will see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
This episode was sponsored by Hacksoft, your Django development partner beyond code. Learn more about their services in the link in the description.